Good morning, everyone. Could I ask the people who are on Zoom just to put their cameras on so I can see their lovely faces? It always gives a bit more of a feeling for being present, when you're on Zoom. So first of all, I'd like to thank you all for coming out on this beautiful, beautiful spring morning. I find spring is always the time of hope. And yeah, I should tell you about my broad beans that I have on my balcony that are almost 3 feet long, sitting in little starter cups. I was way too hopeful for them. I don't think they'll ever make it in the garden. The talk I'm giving today is titled The Leap of Faith, which is perhaps a really good thing for this time of year. I want to begin with a something that happened to me last year. Last year in October, I was heading into over to Vancouver for the opening retreat of the practice period. I live on Main Island, or Skitak, which is the indigenous name, a small southern Gulf island, with my husband Harold and our aged beloved pet Otis. Leaving the island is always a complex process. My husband's health requires him to be in a respite facility in Victoria when he is not with me, and I needed to find a home for the dog while I was away. To make things easier while I was going to the city, I decided to take my car. We were off to a rocky start on Friday with little sleep and a lot of anxiety when we took the early morning ferry into Victoria. I checked Harold into the Piercy Respite Hotel at about 11 a.m. and then dashed to the ferry that goes from Swartz Bay to Tawassan on the mainland. Usually at this time of day and year, there isn't too much of a threat to not catching the ferry if you were there at least an hour in advance. When I arrived at the ticket booth at 11:30, the agent told me that the next ferry I could get on was 7 o'clock that evening. It seems that there was a ferry out of commission and hence the backup. I begged the agent to make an exception for me, telling him I'd had so much trouble getting there. He patiently explained that there was nothing he could do. I begged some more. He said he was sorry, but that I would have to move on. I got about 10 feet from the wicket when I stopped my car and I yelled back, "Can I get on as a foot passenger?" And he said, "Yes, there's still room on the 1 o'clock for foot passengers." So I drove forward and I stopped in the ferry terminus because I had to figure out what to do with my car and dropping it off and getting back and all the rest of it. I could hear in a distance a woman, one of the ferry officers, saying, "You have to leave the terminus. You are not allowed to stop here." I didn't want to leave the terminus because the next thing was the Pat Bay Highway, and I didn't want to try and figure out at 90 kilometers an hour what I was supposed to do. So finally, this woman drove up and she said, "You have to leave the terminus." And I said, "Well, I'm just really trying to figure out where I go, and I have to figure out what to do with my car." And she said, "Well, you know, there is parking up above." I hadn't thought about that, and so I did that. So I went up above, and after, well, I should say, I attempted to go up above. I headed out of the parking lot and ended up back on the highway, having to do a return once again to the upper parking area. When I got there, it took six tries to get my credit card accepted, and then I flew from the car, taking just what I could carry, and went into a very busy waiting room. Many other people had faced the same conditions as myself, and so there were a lot of walk-ons. When I got into the ferry room, I sort of collapsed into a seat and immediately called my daughter who was at work, but I left a message on her phone telling her all the woes that I had been going through. And then I got off the phone and I phoned my sister, who was at home. So I reiterated everything that was going wrong and had gone wrong. And then I got off the phone. There was a young woman in the seat beside me. She was all dressed in black with black makeup, looking about in her late 30s. She leaned over to me and looked me in the eye and she said, "You've got to keep the faith." Well, that stopped me in my tracks. My whirling, frantic mind just crashed into the present moment. I looked at her and I said, "You have no idea how often I say that to myself." Now I'm going to go back and find where I am in my script. It was a moment of decision. Did I want to connect with this person, or did I want to go back to my endless loop of how difficult things were in my life? I decided to take a chance and reach out. We began to share small talk, where we lived, what we did, quickly discovered we had many things in common. She was a member of a small Catholic congregation, St. Anthony's in Marple in Vancouver. This just happened to be the same church and adjoining elementary school that I had spent much of my younger life in. Our conversation over the next 3 hours went deeper and deeper. You can always tell when you're hitting bedrock when you start talking about your mothers, which we did. It turned out that our mothers had died around the same time, about 5 years ago. Her mother died at the age of 67 after seemingly neglecting her health. My mother was 97 and still not ready to die. She took out a photograph of her mother from her wallet, and I realized that we were close to the same age. When we parted at the SkyTrain station, I turned to her and said, "I want to channel your mother." I put my hands on her shoulders and looked deeply at her. As her mother, I told her how proud I was of her and what a great job that she was doing with her life. I cautioned her that she shouldn't make my past her future. Then we parted to travel on our ways. You got to keep the faith. What does this phrase mean? And in particular, what is faith? The dictionary says that faith is the belief without evidence, a belief in God. It often engenders a sense of trust, a confidence that you can meet difficult situations with a feeling of support. With Buddhism, the term faith is not used much. Buddhism, being a non-theistic tradition, where there is no belief in an external God. What is spoken of is our universal nature or our Buddha nature, which is our birthright, that which is the birthright of all living things. So with Buddhism, rather than faith, they often speak of confidence or trust in your Buddha nature. Also, in Buddhism, there is no end goal like going to heaven or even achieving enlightenment. As we all have this Buddha nature, it is more a process of discovery. A phrase I heard many years ago put it this way: seek not love, for love is a constant state. Rather, seek to know the ways that you are blocking it. Faith in my childhood as a practicing Catholic was a faith in God. I turned from that faith as a teenager because I was never comfortable with being told what to believe. It also didn't seem to be just. My grandmother, who was perhaps the kindest person that I knew, was going to hell because she no longer went to church. While many of the people that did go to church were mean-spirited, but would nevertheless go to heaven. It just didn't make sense to me. So I left the faith of my childhood and put my fervor into the secular world. In my 20s, I went as a CUSO volunteer and lived in Sierra Leone in West Africa for 3 years. I met, married, and left my first husband, Bala, a Sierra Leonean, during this time. Actually, I still carry his last name. Ture is his name. When I returned to Canada, I joined an intentional community which was based in social justice and ecological principles, where I lived for the next 3 decades of my life, marrying my second husband and raising our 2 children there. However, the issue of faith and my religious inclinations did not disappear from my life. I thought I had replaced them with social and political activism, but I hadn't. In my mid-30s, I found myself back, literally on my knees, now in Buddhism. During my first residential retreat, which was at Hollyhock with a Vipassana teacher by the name of Alan Clements, he gave a talk in which he said, "You need 3 things to pursue the path of enlightenment. 1, commitment, because without it, nothing happens. 2, courage, because you're going to have to take a leap in the dark. 3, faith, which transforms into wisdom with experience, so that when you take the leap, there is something there to catch you." The retreat was a very difficult one for me. I hurt on every level, my body, my mind, and my emotions. Plus, I coughed the whole way through the retreat. When I went for my interview with the teacher, I told him I thought I was pretty good with commitment and courage, but I didn't even know where to look for faith. I said I didn't seem to be able to make enlightenment into anything other than a stick with which to beat myself. He asked, "Well, what would it feel like if you were enlightened?" I said, "I don't know, but it sure as hell wouldn't feel like this. This feels awful." He said, "Ah, you are not seeking enlightenment. You are seeking comfort." I felt nailed to the wall and asked with some indignation, "So what's wrong with comfort?" I have come to experience that the spiritual path, the Buddha way, is often not comfortable. This, of course, is the first of the noble truths proclaimed by the Buddha. Life is suffering, the great law of dukkha. The path of awareness usually begins with dissatisfaction. I have some illustrious company in these raw beginnings. Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha to be, at the age of 29, fled from his home, abandoned his wife and young child, and profoundly disappointed his father, who wanted Siddhartha to follow in his rules, in his footsteps as a ruler. He left behind a life of privilege and comfort. His resolve was to understand the nature of suffering and how to end it. For 6 years, he followed the ways of a wandering ascetic, a spiritual seeker, bringing himself to the edge of death before his great moment of awakening under the Bodhi tree. Dogen, the 13th century founder of Soto Zen, which is the lineage of Mountain Rain, was plagued with great doubt in his spiritual search. His central question was, if we are already enlightened by our natures, then why do we need to work so hard at our practice? Dogen's background. He was born in Japan into a wealthy family who held important positions in the court. His father died when Dogen was 2 years old, and his mother died when he was 7. So Dogen was intimately aware of the impermanence of life from a very young age. His mother apparently expressed a dying wish that Dogen should follow the Buddhist way. This orphan child was adopted by an influential uncle who had great political ambitions for this exceedingly bright child. When Dogen was 12, he fled from the court and turned to his uncle for permission to enter a monastery. His uncle at first disapproved of this plan, but later recanted when Dogen spoke of his mother's deathbed wishes. Subsequently, Dogen entered a powerful monastic order in the Tendai tradition, and he was ordained 1 year later. This, however, did not quell his sense of dissatisfaction, and 2 years later, he renounced and left the monastery. He was propelled on by his great doubt, which is summed up succinctly in the record of Kinsey. Quote, "If all sentient beings possess Buddha nature and the Tathagata exists without change, then why must a person develop the aspiration for awakening and vigorously engage in austerities in order to realize the truth? To put it more simply, we are all already enlightened because that is our basic nature. Then why do we have to work so hard?" In one of his earliest writings, the Fukansa Zenji of the Universal Recommendation for Zazen, Dogen expressed it this way. "Fundamentally, the basis of the way is thoroughly pervasive, so how can it be contingent on practice and realization? The vehicle of the ancestors is naturally unrestricted, then why should we expend sustained effort? Surely, whole being is far beyond defilement, so who can believe in a method to cultivate it? Never is the way apart from the very place, from this very place. So what is the use of journeying to practice it? Yet, if there is a hair's breadth of distinction between existence and training, this gap becomes as great as that between heaven and earth. Once the slightest sense of liking or disliking something arises, confusion reigns, and one's mind is hopelessly lost in delusion." It wasn't until Dogen had undertaken a very dangerous journey to China, studied with his esteemed mentor Ru Jing, when at the age of 25 he had a great spiritual awakening that helped to resolve this doubt. After his return from China, Dogen wrote in a more positive vein about the significance of undergoing doubt for attaining spiritual realization. In Discerning the Way, he wrote, "Although the Dharma or the teachings is allotted amply to everyone, when we have not practiced properly, it does not appear. And when we do not realize this, it is not attained. Let it go and it fills the hand. How could it ever be limited by one versus many? Speak of it and it fills the mouth vertically and horizontally without boundary." Doubt and the dissatisfaction it engenders seem to be a necessary precursor to investigation. This is because doubt questions the status quo and is based in uncertainty. But doubt that is unbounded can become cynicism. This comes from the believing that people are at heart selfish and untrustworthy. It's a sort of hardening of the heart, often because of disappointment with oneself or others around us. It's a sort of giving up. The belief that your actions will have no impact. Often the world seems to support this belief, with corrupt politicians, greedy business practices, senseless wars, careless destruction of the environment, and many of the species that we share this planet with. Faith is the panacea of cynicism because it transcends reason or intellectual understanding. Faith is based in the belief of human kindness that comes from the heart. Faith focuses on a larger sense of self, our universal or Buddha nature. However, faith that is not tempered by humility and doubt can lead to a narrow-minded religious zeal, a blind faith. I think the leap of faith is exemplified in the koan, a 100-foot pole. Koans are a sort of ancient Chinese teaching stories. Here is the koan it comes from, the gateless gate, case 46. Step from the top of the pole, the case. The priest, Shixuang, said, "How do you stop? How do you step from the top of a 100-foot pole?" Another eminent master of former times said, "You who sit on the top of a 100-foot pole, take a step from the top of the pole, and the worlds of the 10 directions are your total body." This is some of the commentary. The cornerstone of Buddhism is dependent origination. That is, that all things arise together in unison within the constant flow of change. Within this full dynamic functioning, there is nothing that is separate or apart. That is referred to as emptiness or no separate self. But if emptiness is seen from the aloof mind, that is serene but disconnected from the suffering in the world, it is a sickness. That is why emptiness or wisdom needs to be balanced by compassion. The word compassion literally means calm is with and passion is suffering. So it means to be with suffering, your own and others. In Mumon's The Gateless Gate, case 46, Master Sekiso says, "From the top of a pole 100 feet high, how do you step forward?" Another ancient master, Mumon, tells us, "One sitting at the top of a pole 100 feet high, even if he has attained it, has not yet truly been enlightened. He must step forward from the top of the pole 100 feet high and manifest his whole body in the 10 directions." Reaching the top of the pole could be seen as a metaphor for having achieved some insight into one's ultimate nature. We may have some major spiritual openings, often during retreats or periods of intensive practice. You might gain some clarity and insight. But at some point after the retreat ends, or when we encounter circumstances that trigger our emotional reactivity and bring forth our unresolved psychological issues and defenses, we are likely to find that our realizations have barely penetrated our conditioned personality. This self we carry with us, with all its habits and concerns, remains mostly intact despite all our progress. So it seems that if you do take the leap from the 100-foot pole, and maybe you do sense your ultimate nature, be aware of the ground below. These ancient stories, do they hold any relevance for us today? faith in our 21st century technological and materialistic society is often seen as a sort of old-fashioned superstitious idea, certainly not very scientific. It is comprised of beliefs that can't be proven or measured. It is not about achieving anything. That's not to say that we don't care about our lives and how they impact others. We care deeply. We make vows, set intentions, and practice, practice, practice. Our whole life is a struggle between fear and love, and between doubt and faith. Both faith and doubt are needed to balance each other, logos and eros, reason and heart. We tread the path of the middle way, often finding ourselves lost, but hopefully with a confidence that when we leap, there will be something there to catch us. What would you do at the top of a 100-foot pole? Thank you very much for listening. I hope you all have a wonderful day, full of leaps.